Eric Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
They have unfortunately turned us into a spoiler. And we don't want to be a spoiler. We wanted to win. We wanted a fair shot.
RFK Jr.'s running mate explains how the Democrats pushed him away and apparently into Mr. Trump's loving arms. You're going to hear it for yourself. We're going to let you see that. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. All right, RFK Jr. Obviously, his uncle was the president. His father would have been president had he not been shot. A prominent member of one of the most famous Democratic families in U.S. history, he's going to quit the race and possibly endorse Donald Trump. And to hear his running mate tell it, it's happening because he's been treated so poorly, she says, by the Democratic Party.
This DNC-aligned pack that was created specifically to take us out has spent millions of dollars to take us out. They have unfortunately turned us into a spoiler. And we don't want to be a spoiler. We wanted to win. We wanted a fair shot. The DNC made that impossible for us. They have banned us, shadow banned us, kept us off stages, manipulated polls, used lawfare against us, sued us in every possible state. They've even planted insiders into our campaign to disrupt it and to create actual legal issues for us.
So let's talk about this. Obvious question. Will he actually endorse Trump, and what's he going to get for doing so? These things always have a price, right? There is talk of a cabinet position, but it's not firmed up yet. Why is he out? Why is he out? Money? Time and a drop in poll numbers? Possibly. Who's he going to really help in this, right? The obvious answer would seem to be Donald Trump, because he's going to endorse Donald Trump. But it ain't automatic, you know what I mean? It depends on how he sells it and how Mr. Trump sells it, maybe perhaps during their announcement. Remember, his followers tend to dislike both parties, right? So convincing them to make that jump is going to be kind of hard. And it may even help Harris, because aligning with Trump could anger some of his followers who don't want him to align with anybody. This is quite a pickle here, you know? Manila, this whole thing is probably going to work itself out. It's going to be fun to watch it. Now, what are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be fun to watch. But to Nicole Shanahan's point, she's absolutely right. The Democratic side of this, you know, political show that we have here in the United States has been proven over and over that while that particular party stands, they say, for pro-choice when it comes to women's rights, they're not so pro-choice when it comes to the ballot box. And we've seen how they've treated RFK Jr., which is why he jumped ship. They were not going to allow that wing, if we can call it that, of the Democrats to actually be successful or have a real chance at being on the DNC ticket in the primaries, because we didn't even see a primary for the Democrats. So to her point, she's absolutely right. She's pulling the veil back on how it's actually done.
But
now that he has gone independent, the numbers have gone down, Rick, steadily in decline since he left the party. But a lot of the polls do show that if people were poached, we'll call it that, because I don't believe people are, should or have to vote one party or the other. But if theoretically, if he were poaching from anybody, he'd be mostly poaching from Trump voters, because the people that are on the Democratic side have already drank the Kool-Aid and they're going to vote blue no matter who. So the party he would have been hurting would have been the Republicans. In this case, it's Donald Trump. So for him to go and potentially, we don't know, potentially, you know, square a deal behind closed doors somewhere, then, you know, that's kudos to him. And that's great for Kennedy and the mission that he has and whatever that is. And so I think if he backs Trump, I think it'll actually help Trump, because it'll bring the people back to the Republican Party.
We disagree. I think he's going to end up having absolutely no effect, a minimal effect, or maybe even going the other way and helping Harris, because so many of those people are going to look at it as, the reason I was going to vote for you is because I didn't want to vote for Trump. So don't tell me what to do kind of thing. But we'll see.
They hate Harris more than they hate Trump, I think, those particular voters.
Okay. There is starting to be some real bickering in the Democratic Party about how President Joe Biden was treated on the first night of the election. This is new. The president was supposed to give his final goodbye in prime time around 8 or 9 o'clock.
But guys, it's really getting late now, so let's wrap up the other speakers and bring out Joe.
Please welcome Congressman Jim Clyburn.
Raphael Warnock, Kathy Hochul, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Jamie Raskin, Jasmine Crockett, Chris Coons.
And I want to talk with you for just a few minutes.
Jesus Christ. Is this still going on? No disrespect to Chris Coons, but Chris Coons. It is almost midnight. Mom has got to get to bed. And you know who else has to get to bed? Joe Biden. For the love of God, let's hear from Biden.
Please welcome Ashley Biden.
Not that Biden.
That's good. You know, everybody's talking about it since it happened. He didn't even get on stage until, like, the primetime audience was gone and they had all gone to bed. So most Americans didn't even get to see the President of the United States with his, you know, farewell speech. Was it done on purpose? Well, Democratic convention officials say it happened because there were just too many long ovations and the night went long. Funny how that didn't happen when Mr. Obama spoke or when Mr. Clinton spoke afterward. The fact of the matter is the Democratic Party seems to be done with Mr. Biden. And while it may make sense from a political standpoint to try and win the election to do so, you know, to do it that way just seems a little harsh, you know, just a little harsh. And here's Nancy Pelosi, by the way. She finally got nailed down on this thing. Jake Tapper and what's her name over at CNN sat her down during the convention and asked her, did she push Biden out of the race?
It does seem like there's some residual bad blood or resentment, and I'm wondering if you've spoken to him and what your response is to that.
Sometimes you just have to take a punch for the children. He made the decision for the country. My concern was not about the president. It was about his campaign. As he has seen the exuberance, the excitement that has come forth in our country. I just did an event for one of our members in Illinois, Eric Sorensen, today. Immediately, he got 1,100 volunteers into his campaign as soon as that announcement was made.
Nobody is questioning the fact that the Democratic Party seems much better positioned right now than it did 4 weeks and 2 days ago. There's no question about that. Former Speaker Pelosi.
So why are we even talking about it?
Yeah, why are we even talking about this thing? You know, it's interesting. She says she didn't go after Biden. She went after his campaign. Isn't that the same thing? I'm just curious.
Manila. Oh, my God, Rick. Again, it just shows you that the DNC machine just chews you up and spits you out when you are no longer useful to it. And in this case, Biden was the poor spat out fool that they used for a couple of years to achieve their means, was to get, you know, Donald Trump out of office. That was the end goal. And he was the means. And I guess, you know, poor old Joe and whatever 40-year friendship he thought he had with Nancy Pelosi, that's out the door as well.
I like the way.
There's no such thing as loyalty.
Well,
and
by the way,
that's why they say get a dog.
Yeah, and by the way, they're right. I mean, he was hurting the party. They didn't want to have him on, and they've done everything possible to remove him, and I guess it's within their right to do so. It just seems like it's a little cruel, and once again, the point that I always make on this show is just be transparent about it and just say it. Yes, we asked him to step down because he was essentially blowing it for the party. And we had to do it, and it hurt, but we did it. Instead, it's like all this double talk about, well, we didn't really want him to go away. We just wanted his campaign to go away. Well, he is the campaign. All right, one more thing, Manila. Did you watch last night? Were you watching last night?
I did as much as I could, but I got to tell you, Stevie Wonder. was what I watched for.
I'm a political guy, so I watch for Bill Clinton. He's my Stevie Wonder. And just watch Bill Clinton. Go.
You think they're kidding, but I know a lot of these folks. And most of them are really good people. But some of them think that they are bound to dominate America politically, economically, and socially, and they have to use politics to do it, and they should rig the system. I don't believe that.
Isn't that something? He looked feeble. His hands, you know, were shaking. His voice was cracking. He was raspy.
I know.
For me, this is human drama we're talking about here. It was fascinating to see a guy who I personally think is one of the greatest presidential communicators who's ever lived. I don't care what they say about Reagan and Obama. I know there's people who are going to put their votes in for them. To suddenly see him in that light, it kind of shocked me. I didn't expect it. But, you know, it is what it is. And Father Time has come a-knocking.
Well, Rick, we got to point out he is 78 years old. He's just slightly younger than Donald Trump and several years younger than President Biden is right now. But I think when we as spectators, forget being journalists, we as world spectators, when we think of Bill Clinton, we think of him in his glory days when he was in the Oval Office. I mean, at the time, when he was first inaugurated, he was 46 years old. I mean, he was the third youngest president ever inaugurated, and to this day, right? So I think we all think of him in that prime, in that heyday.
Yeah, but it's
ever
more,
since
but,
then,
but
he it's, has, but, he's been fraught with health problems, Rick.
But it's more than that. I mean, George Bush was young, too, and he sounded like an idiot every time he talked. There was something about Bill Clinton, which made him one of the
it factor.
More than Obama, more than just about everybody else. He had that thing back then, and to see him,
he had the thing. He was a great orator, and time has caught up, Rick. He's 78 years old. He's got the case of the handshakes, which is usually part and parcel of Parkinson's disease.
Yeah,
and,
I didn't want to say
his
that,
voice
but
is getting hoarse and.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Listen, it's
our politicians are getting older, I guess. All you got to do is turn on the TV and watch any political show, and you see these guys, like the great senator from the state of Kentucky, who every once in a while just seems to go into some cerebral
Mitch
situation.
McConnell.
Yeah,
oh boy,
it's
that's
hard.
A whole different.
Hard to watch. Hard to watch. All right, so.
It's sad. It's sad.
Thank you, kiddo. We'll talk to you again very soon. When we come back, China. China. We discuss a big story that has gotten little to no attention this week by the mainstream media about the United States altering its nuclear strategy to focus on China. And KJ Ngo is a journalist, he's an author, he's a political analyst, and the perfect person to discuss this story with because he might know a little bit about it. So stay right there. We're going to come right back. China and nukes. Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's continue this. You know, while most people are thinking, as Manila and I were just talking about a little while ago, that Joe Biden's presidency is finished, he's somewhere in like Palm Beach, California on a beach right now, literally, we're told. There's a report in the New York Times that seems to be suggesting not so fast in what is a huge story that is being generally ignored by the U.S. media, because who cares about the possibility of nuclear war, right? The Biden administration is revising its nuclear strategy with an emphasis on China. Where'd this come from? Why? Because according to the Nuclear Employment Guidance, that's what they're calling it. It sounds like a jobs program. And when you think of it, it probably kind of is. The Pentagon is concerned that China's nuclear stockpiles will rival the, quote, size and the diversity of the United States and Russia's over the next decade. So that's why they're doing all of this. Wow. Talk about out of left field. Joining us now to talk about this is KJ Ngo. KJ is an author. He's a journalist. He's a teacher. He's a geopolitical analyst. And he's also the host of The China Report on Breakthrough News. Congratulations on that, KJ. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure to be with you.
So what gives? I mean, what is it that the United States is saying they have just found out about China that is so important? What's your take?
Well, I think we have to take all of these things with both a grain of salt and also do some deep analysis around them. If you remember, in the early 2000s, there was this thing called the Tulo Panic. I don't know if you know, have you ever seen the film Mulan, that you know, martial arts?
Of course.
And do you remember those big circular houses?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the U.S., in the early 2000s, they came out with this report saying that China had created scores of new nuclear silos, and this was a deadly threat to the United States. Hmm. It turned out on closer examination that these were these 500-year-old Chinese circular houses where, you know, clans live inside them. They're made out of mud. They're 500 years old, and the U.S. was saying that these were new nuclear silos. So there's a little bit of a history of threat inflation. And if I may go so far as to give you the actual statistics, in 1984, the DIA, the Pentagon, estimated that China had a little under 200 nuclear weapons, warheads, but they estimated there would be 800 in a decade. Then they... when none of those projections came true. So in 1999, they said, well, they still have 200, but within 20 years, they'll have 500. That didn't come true. And then in 2019, they said, well, they still have around 200, but we estimate in 15 years, they'll have 1,500. So there's this constant history of threat inflation, which is not upheld by the facts. The facts are that China has a very, very minimal nuclear deterrent. It's the absolute minimum that they believe is necessary, kind of almost a symbolic deterrent. Mm. They have no launch on warning. Their warheads are detached from the vehicles, and they have no first strike policy. Whereas
US... In fact, I was just going to add to that. I was just checking on it. Russia has the most nuclear warheads. They have 5,500, and according to AI overview, the United States has 5,044. They have 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, according to these reports. China's not anywhere near any of that. So I would imagine some people would be saying, well, what's up? And what? How are the Chinese reacting to this?
Well, the Chinese are not happy about this at all. They say that this is the U.S.'s attempt to create an escalation dominance, to create a pretext for escalation dominance. Essentially, they're saying the U.S. is using this to shirk its responsibilities to meaningfully negotiate, nuclear reductions, and instead to use this as a pretext for nuclear escalation and nuclear dominance. I think, personally, it's a little bit more ominous than that. I think what this is trying to do, and remember, this is from the New York Times, right? This is the White House correspondent working at the New York Times. I think that what they're trying to do, and this is clearly a leak that was fed to him, is they're trying to normalize the idea of nuclear war with China. It's their fault. Therefore, you know, think about it. We're going to go to... We don't want to, but, you know, it looks like we're going to have nuclear war with China. And we see this right now in Korea. They're rehearsing nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. The Deputy National Security Advisor has threatened to nuke China, nuke North Korea, which essentially is the same thing as waging war with China. And the deputy doesn't have that authority to say any of those things unless he was authorized.
Well... It always seems to come back, these conversations, doesn't it, to the fact that having an escalation is fruitful and profitable for certain people in the military-industrial complex sphere. How much of that do you think is involved in this?
Oh, I'm certainly. I mean, the industry is very, very much a part of it, right? It's a huge part of... the military-industrial complex. And also remember, as the economic system starts to fail, traditionally what has been done, the reboot is war. So this is their thinking about using war to reboot the economy. So that's definitely very much part of it. But I think that what we really have to watch out for is nuclear war is not something you trifle with. Currently, the U.S. war doctrine is nuclear first strike. It's what they call NUTS, nuclear utilization target selection, which is a counterforce doctrine where you simply preemptively strike your enemy first. In other words, the U.S. doctrine of war against China and other countries is the nuclear sucker punch.
Why would anybody in our government go along with something like that? What? I can understand the profit motive behind this, but, you know, some bureaucrat, I guess, I don't know, the Pentagon, the State Department, wherever it is, the people who are involved in these decisions, all the way up to the White House, why would they do something like that? What's the motivation there, KJ?
I think it's decades and decades of accrued institutional stupidity. It didn't happen overnight. This has been building up for a while. Presidential Directive 59, which authorized counterforce strikes, first strikes, was done in 1980. We're talking about decades. That was Jimmy Carter. And so this is decades of accrued ideological stupidity, institutional stupidity that has led to these kind of ideological blinders that they believe that either they exert dominance or they threaten to end the world. They would rather see the end of the planet than the end of their power and privilege. I think that's what it boils down to. It's a little bit like asking, why does the school shooter want to take out the entire school? There's a mental illness there, but for these people, the ruling neocon elite class, for them, the entire world is the school.
Wow. Let me ask you about China. Are they escalating their nuclear proliferation? And if not, will this make them more apt to do so, you fear?
You know, I think that's the $64,000 question. Nobody has a good answer to that right now. I'm sure they're thinking about really hard, because essentially what the U.S. has done in this declaration is it's declared a nuclear pivot. In 2011, it declared pivot to Asia. That is, we're containing China, we're escalating to war with China. Mm-hmm. And then recently, they've declared the nuclear pivot to China. This is what this is. Even though China's known arsenal is only one fraction, what is it? It's 1/20th of what the U.S. has, and nothing is actually assembled for war. The warheads are separated from delivery vehicles. So what are the Chinese thinking? We can look back to history, what they did in the past. Once again, in the 1960, 1961, there was a presidential directive. Essentially, the plan was to nuke China, just for the hell of it. If we go to war with the Soviet Union, we'll also nuke all of China's cities, and we expect anywhere from 60 to 90% destruction of all of China's cities. That was the plan in the 1960s. Now, how did the Chinese respond? Did they go on a rampage and do a kind of nuclear arms race like the Soviet Union? No, they didn't. I'll tell you what they did, and it's something which will astonish you. During that period, the Chinese were very aware that the U.S. would obliterate all their cities along the coastline, which was the industrial core. And so what the Chinese did secretly, and they kept the secret for decades, was that they rebuilt their entire infrastructure inside the interior of the country along hidden mountains where nobody knew this was happening. It's almost as if you can imagine the United States decided to rebuild Chicago, Pittsburgh, New York, LA, San Jose, inside the mountains of the Rockies and Wyoming, and nobody knew about it. Now, if you go there, if you go to Chongqing, you'll see there's a Manhattan that is sprouting out of the mountains. But the Chinese approach is to build, not bomb. So I think they'll try and de-escalate this, and they'll try and look for some kind of constructive way to talk the United States down from this nuclear madness.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Let's hope they have a moment of de-escalation by having more dialogue, something that's missing across the board right now. And once again, you and I are having a discussion about a story that you probably will not even hear if you happen to live in the United States and watch cable news or read any of the major big city newspapers. And that ain't right. But thanks, KJ, for sharing your insight on this. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
That's our show. Remember, always be looking outside your own box. Truths, they don't live in boxes, as we like to say. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.